Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Excuse me, we ran a little long in closed session. This is the regularly scheduled March 16th board meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District. And we will begin our meeting with an announcement of items from closed session. We discussed two matters of anticipated litigation and provided direction to staff. And we received a report regarding negotiations, and I guess we did provide direction to staff. Yes, we did provide direction to staff, darn it. So we'll go with approval of the minutes. Anybody?
I'll move that we approve the minutes for March 2nd.
I'll second. Any discussion, corrections? Motion by Mr. Angel, second by the chair. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes 7-0. Okay, we move on to public comment. We do have some requests to speak. We'll start with Denny McKee, followed by Carol, I always had the hardest time with this last name, Cachese, thank you. Hey, Denny, go ahead, please.
You got there. Let's try to turn it on. Thanks a lot. My name's Denny McKee. I'm from San Luis Obispo. A few weeks ago, I proposed a student bill of rights. The first right I proposed was that skills will be taught to mastery. It stated that if a certain percentage of the class, say 25% or more, score less than 80% on a test or a particular set of skills, the student can expect reteaching will take place until mastery is verified through retesting. If the number is less than 25% of the class, then there still needs to be a plan for those students who didn't demonstrate mastery. Some might disagree with that proposal as saying it's unreasonable expectation. If that is so, then I'd like you to ponder, what if 100% of the students in class scored poorly on a test? Would it still be considered unreasonable to expect reteaching will take place in order to remedy the situation? If the answer is that it is still unreasonable to expect reteaching will take place in class, then that begs another question. Why even teach something if there's not an expectation the students will learn the skill? But if one believes that reteaching should occur when 100% of the students do poorly on a test, what if 90% do poorly? And if one believes that reteaching should occur if 90% do poorly, what if the number is 80%, 70%, 60%? Should reteaching occur if 50% do poorly on a test? My reason for asking these questions is because I believe there should be some measurable trigger that identifies when something like reteaching should take place. Teachers and schools use measurable data to fail students in a course as well as pass them in a course. Why not use some form of measurable data to determine when reteaching should take place? If the goal is for the students to be proficient in a subject, then the teacher and the school needs to be actively involved when students don't demonstrate mastery of the material. Leaving it up to the student to ferret out how to teach themselves to mastery or ask for help is flat out wrong. A remedy or reteaching should automatically kick in, and it should be spearheaded by a teacher and the school. Thank you.
Thank you, Denny. As always, in unscheduled public appearances, the Brown Act prohibits the board from taking up the matter and discussing it and responding to the person's statements. So if we sit here like bumps on a log, that's why we are, but we do hear you. Carol, and then followed by Debbie Heck.
I'm Carol Cachese. I'm a teacher at Hawthorne Elementary School, and I'm here tonight in celebration of a couple of items. First is our mission statement for our school district. We have a most wonderful mission statement that says that we educate students to become self-sufficient individuals who are capable of making significant contributions to society and managing change in the culturally diverse world community. Our district guarantees to provide the highest quality programs and services, which will give all individuals the opportunity to realize their full intellect. In these programs have been notified that their contract will not be renewed, as it happens every year with temporary employees, but this year they've been told that they will absolutely not be rehired. This cannot happen without great discussion and dialogue. I don't know what it takes to keep a program in effect, what you look at, what students you look at, but these students are valuable and they deserve this program and these teachers.
Thank you. Debbie, followed by Naomi Blakely.
Hi, my name is Debbie Heck and I teach here at Laguna Middle School. I'm also here tonight to support these 10 teachers that have been pink slipped and to support the program that they work for. We were talking with some of the teachers and a few of them shared some very important facts, and I just wanted to share some with you. One of the things that I was really impressed with is that they had told us that many of their clients in the past have been institutionalized, living at Casa de Vida and other places. But now, because of these clients participating in these programs where Carol had listed, some of them now are very independent. They're living on their own, living in apartments. Some of them have jobs. They pay taxes. And they're voting citizens. I would say that that is a quality indicator of a program that is really doing a good job. Our San Luis Coastal teachers are the only credentialed teachers with a specialty in disability education that work with these clients. Even though they work in conjunction with other programs, our teachers are the only ones that are credentialed teachers. The people from the other programs are minimally paid workers, and because of that reason, they tend to come and go. Our teachers have provided the stability that these people need. Many of these teachers have been working with these clients for 25 to 30 years, and that's the stability their clients make and need. These teachers have offered the stability that these clients need for a very long time. They are committed and dedicated to these clients, and I hope that our district will also be committed and dedicated to these people.
Thank you, Demi. Naomi, and followed by Phil Gammon.
I'm Naomi Blakely. I taught at Casa de Vida for 14 years, Knowles with the credentials in functional living for handicapped adults. We were able to identify the need and find ways creatively to fill it, not relying wholly on the district for support, but branching out into the community. And it has been a wonderful collaborative community-district relationship, which I would hate to see severed at this point, even given the horrible budget mess that we're in. I was one of those teachers who every year was pink-slipped as an hourly. It's not a contract position. They're hourly positions. And while we were pink slipped, we were, and Proposition 13, by the way, passed on a Tuesday, we were fired the next day. And fortunately, we were rehired the following week. It feels like this is deja vu all over again. I'm hoping that possibly you're not quite aware of what is being suggested and all of the implications and ramifications, because knowing how you support and believe in our mission as a district, I can't understand why, once folks leave, that would no longer be important. The other night, I was looking at a video that we made in 1987, where we five teachers did a sort of a review of individuals with whom we worked and the differences that we made in their lives. The young man that I had worked with used an early communication device and wound up living independently. He had spastic quadriplegia, cerebral palsy, lived independently until the day he died. Another young man became a floral arranger. I mean, these are skills, these are real skills that earned them. A young woman I did job training with at Burger King, where she went and and did her job every day at Burger King, and the boss was on talking about how she was the best employee they had. So I'm asking you to please really consider the cost-benefit ratio of retaining these teachers and retaining your relationship with our community and honoring the lives of the folks that we've served. Thank you.
Thank you, Naomi. Phil Gammons. And then David Perez.
Hello, my name is Phil Gammons. I live in San Luis Obispo. I raised both of my kids all the way through coastal schools, and still raising grandchildren. I have a second grader at C.L. Smith, my granddaughter second year Berkeley. I have two fathers with disabilities. When I first started way back in the 60s, we were just beginning to bring people with disabilities out of the old state hospital systems, where many of the people had spent their entire lives because in their communities there were no schools, there were no programs for these people back in those days. We've come a long way. I would hate to see us start to move backwards. What got me here tonight, I guess, was reading that San Luis Costa was looking at, oh, we're going to lay off some temps. I've worked with a lot of the temps that work with adults with disabilities in many local programs. And I was asking a couple of the people I work with back here how long you've been a temp, and it's 24 years, 27 years. And these are people that are dedicated. They didn't have long-term contracts or all the benefits. They came back every year, and they are such an important part of these programs. And I think, you know, they're not just temps. These are human beings who have committed their lives, and they are the mentors in these programs. As one of the speakers said, they mentor the other staff, which are not too far above minimum wage in some of these programs. So I would encourage the board to, whenever possible, I know funding's tight, everything's tight, but I would hate to see us start making backward steps in working with our disabled students of all ages, children and adults. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. David Perez, and then Janet Gould.
My name's David Bettis, and I'm a teacher with adults with disabilities. I've taught proudly for the school district at the Achievement House, and the reason I'm proud of what I've done out there is because I'm proud of the... I got a speech here, so... I'm proud of the fact that there are 44 years of a unique partnership between San Luis Coastal and Pathpoint and Achievement House and Casa de Vida. So before you make your final decision, I'd like to invite you out to our sites and come and see what we do. And then maybe you'll be proud too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Be able to come. In addition to the barbecue, we have fantastic activities for the students, face painting, basketball, arts and crafts that are led by a former Del Mar student who's now pursuing her teaching credential. We also have a silent and live auction that's full of wonderful items that the classrooms have made, beautiful art auction items, as well as many donations from the community. So I hope that you can make it. One final thing we're also selling is tickets for a cow plot, where for a $10 ticket you can win a chance at $1,000. And again, this is to support our PTA. Last year we raised about $35,000, and it's money that goes directly back into our school for assemblies and field trips. And for instance, this year we were able to purchase LCD projectors and document cameras for each of our classrooms. So we're proud of our PTA and the work that we're doing, and thank you for your support, and hope that you'll be able to come out and join us this Sunday.
Thank you, Janet, and thank you all for your input during unscheduled public appearance.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Is there somebody else still to speak?
We might have one other speaker. Did you want to speak, Bruce? I would love to see you at the podium. Mm-hmm. Oh.
Thank you, Walter. Hi, I'm Bruce Bedrigian, president of
our teachers union, and I stand before you tonight to implore you to consider the following points before firing teachers who work with the disabled adults in our community. By working tiny miracles, our adult school teachers help our adult disabled students become independent individuals who work within our community. Without these teachers, these adults, some of whom are our own former students, will probably be institutionalized at a significantly greater cost to our community as a whole. I've always believed in our district. Sure, I criticize, complain, and question certain decisions. However, I also applaud, congratulate, and celebrate our ability to do the right thing. And the right thing is not always the most fiscally responsible option. Sometimes we all must dedicate ourselves to a higher calling that challenges us to stand our moral ground. Today and tomorrow, you have an opportunity to benefit our entire community, not just San Luis Coastal. I implore you to be gracious, generous, and compassionate. You have the money, but it is not your money. It is my money. As a parent, as a taxpayer, it's our community's money. It is time to vote on the side of compassion, to support those who are right, to do right by those individuals who need us the most, because we wanted to do right by our community. And yes, because we wanted to stand by our teachers who have devoted a major portion of their lives to help being disabled adults become contributing members of our society. I have been to the Achievement House. I have witnessed the dedication, the rapport, and the joy that comes back tenfold to our community. Their service remains remarkable, albeit invisible in many ways. Finally, make our district one that our entire community celebrates. Share our wealth so our community does not suffer. Be altruistic. Be compassionate. Do the right thing. Make me proud to be a San Luis Coastal teacher and parent. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Dr.
If I could, I realize that the board doesn't typically respond to comments, but I'm going to sort of take administrative privilege then, perhaps. And I did want to, first of all, welcome the folks and thank you for coming forward to speak tonight. I don't know what level of comfort I have in whatever message I might deliver, but some things that I heard, I at least want you to understand clearly where we are and where we aren't. Maybe that's even more important. The situation with the adults with disabilities teachers is no different than any other temporary teacher at this point. And what we've tried to communicate to our San Luis Coastal family is that, yes, at this point in time, we have not renewed any of the temporary contracts that that are held in the school district, and that touches somewhere between 70 and 80 people. At the same time, we've expressed that the core value that's driving us in the budget development process involves in a hierarchy of two or three things: the preservation of our workforce, of which you are a valued and important part for all of the reasons that were shared tonight. At this point in time, there is the adults with disabilities staff is in no more jeopardy of not returning than is any other temporary staff in San Luis Coastal. So I think the notion that folks have been told absolutely that they will not be coming back is for adults with disabilities. The reason that it's a little bit different with adults with disabilities this year than in past years is that in past years, the adult education budget has been completely separate from the K-12 budget and could not be intermingled. That is, the funds from adult education could not be intermingled with the K-12 budget, and there were no economies to be realized by extended non-renewals of temporary contracts in the adult education field. What has happened in the current budget problems that we have right now is that all funds are designating, not all funds, but significantly more funds, and including adult education funds, have been made entirely flexible and can be used for K-12 or can be used for adult in whatever prioritization a district might choose to do. We're in the process of creating that prioritization, and we're not in a position to restore contracts to any one group of people until we've evaluated the priorities of the entire school district. But that said, you are at no greater risk than any temporary teacher in the school district at this point, K-12 or otherwise, and that our priority is to restore as many of you and as many of them as is humanly possible to do so, for all of the reasons that were stated tonight. So welcome. I'm glad you're here, and I hope we're talking this way next year over a different issue.
Thank you, Dr. Valentine. I was hoping you were going to provide some input to everybody. And I appreciate, the board appreciates very much you taking the time to come speak to us about this issue. And I assure you that the board takes your work, values your work, and also values the students that you care for and help. So thank you for coming in tonight. Okay. And we'll move on to reports by student representatives.
Hello. How are you guys tonight?
Do you have the right sign in front of you?
Yes.
Okay, there it is. Oh, good.
I got it. Can you see it?
There you go.
My name is Rachel Ayotte, and I'm Morobe High School's student representative. I haven't been here in a couple months, so I'm going to recap the past couple months for you all. I've been very busy. What can I say? Coming back from winter break, we had a memorial for Dominic Riolo, who passed away over winter break, and he was a senior and a friend of third. We had our winter formal. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, I'm good. We had winter formal, and we themed it Empire State in memory of Dom, and it was really fun. So that went well. And then moving on to February, that's about it for January. Winter sports started wrapping up, thank you. And then we had National FFA Week, which was the 22nd to the 23rd. Okay. So during National FFA Week, there were a lot of activities. They had Kiss the Cow contest at lunch. And it's a competition between three nominees. And Miss Bueller and Miss Todd and then a student were... were nominated, and everyone puts coins in jars in the office. So I think Candace Buckley, who is a senior, had to kiss the cow, which I started to watch it, then I just had to walk away. And they had trivia over the announcements, so it was really fun. And this month is literally March Madness. The dance show was the 4th and 5th. I hosted it with my friend Sam Bailey. It was really entertaining. They had guests from other dance studios, little kids dancing to a hoedown song. Pretty entertaining. Winter sports banquet was on the 8th. And spring sports are now in full swing, baseball and softball especially. And boys volleyball actually beat Pioneer Valley last week. I think that was their first win in a while, so that was exciting for the boys. I got to witness it. We had our mini mock rock assembly last Wednesday, which is where we show the students what Big Mock Rock is about, and it's kind of like a talent show where kids can mock their favorite rock stars, all that stuff. And the teachers got up and did a piece called Evolution of Dance, so they did different dance pieces throughout time, and Mr. Bedrigian got out there. We have it on videotape, so it's probably on YouTube by now, so you can check that out. And last Friday, on the 12th, we had our third annual Neon Dance. It was pretty cheap, and we had about 400 people attend, which is a record for our school because it's very small. So that was really fun. The spring play, Leading Ladies, is this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7 p.m. in the cafeteria. It's $7 with ASB and $8 without. It's supposed to be a comedy. Boys dressed as girls, something along the lines of that. So we're going to have an assembly and then actually have the car that she was in. It's in a big glass case on a trailer, so we're going to get that in the quad. So hopefully that'll be a big impact on kids before spring break. And there's going to be a college trip on next Thursday and Friday also. They're going down south. They're visiting Pomona, I think maybe UCLA, something like that. I'm not going. I'm not headed south. So that sums it up for the past couple months, and I'll be here next month, I promise. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. And on behalf of the board, I'd like to express our condolences for your loss and the loss for the Morro Bay community. And you were very brave, and you did a good job with your report, and thank you.
Thank you. Sorry for crying.
Let's see. We probably have a report by administrators. By an administrator, Dr. Valentine.
Yeah, if I might. I had the pleasure of attending the District English Learner Advisory Committee meeting last week, as well as working with DLAC, the acronym for that committee, as well as working with DLAC parent representatives in our budget development process. We received valuable input regarding our children who are learning English. As the board knows, services for our English learners is a centerpiece for our district strategic plan, and it was great to hear from parents on that subject. The input was clear, it made common sense, and obviously came collectively from the hearts of parents. Here are ideas which came forward: continued support for students learning English, reading interventions at all levels, counseling and at-risk support, after-school and summer school interventions and accompanying transportation, technology in the classroom, more after-school activities at the middle school, and greater emphasis and assistance with college preparation and attendance. There was also specific input regarding the need to be proactive with English learners and their families, perhaps not waiting for a need to emerge before responding, but rather taking initiative to check up and see that things are going well before they aren't. Parents felt that thorough school orientations were necessary for students and their parents, with guidelines for where to go and who to see and what to do when needs arise. I've shared before that all school issues come down to access to everything. In our strategic plan, we've increased specialized classes, launched AVID, hired specialists, increased aides, supported after-school homework clubs, provided transportation, built-in interventions, reduced the counseling ratios, and made significant strides in certifying our teaching staff to provide services to English learners. I'm proud of the efforts and their yielding results, but they're not enough. The accessibility of our schools and classrooms to students who are learning English is not sufficient. It is an issue for parents, and it is an issue for us in schools to build that accessibility. This is a tough reality to confront in an era of dramatically decreasing resources. Nevertheless, we have communicated with the board that the lead core value in developing the district budget is a commitment to the mission of the district and to the strategic plan goal of closing the achievement gap. The DLAC meeting last week was conducted in Spanish. I accessed the meeting through a headset and an excellent simultaneous translation. I listened carefully and was tired by the end of the meeting. I have to appreciate the experience of parents and particularly students who are learning English who face such challenges without the assistance of electronic devices and smooth translators every day, all day long. I'm grateful for the participation and input of all the parents and others on the DLAC, and whatever we can do to support our kids who face these challenges, we should do. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Valentine. Any other staff reports? Mary? Oh, we do. You have your own thing. Well, before we get to that, let's I skip right past correspondence. We do have correspondence this evening. A letter from Linda Campeggi from Morro Bay High School. Is Linda here? I hate to put words in her mouth, but I'll just summarize the letter. She questions the financial crisis the district claims to be in. She thinks that we should probably roll back administrators, and questions the value of retaining two assistant superintendents. She's concerned about the county special ed programs and whether or not it's going to end up costing us money. and she believes that what we're proposing to eliminate the severely disabled adult prohibit of the board minutes. Okay. Yes, Marilyn?
We also received email correspondence from the leadership of the San Luis Coastal Teachers Association raising some questions about teacher collaboration time, and I've asked for an administrative response in to be provided in the Friday update to the board.
Okay. Dr. Matakovich.
Thank you. We have good news. We are reestablishing our partnership with the San Luis Obispo County Public Health Department. We will be providing two H1N1 free clinics on March 24th. While the disease activity has decreased in recent weeks, it has not completely gone away. So children younger than 10 years of age need two doses. So the Public Health Department will be at Hawthorne School and Monarch Grove after school, 2:30 to 4:30, on the 24th to administer the free vaccine, either nasal spray or injectable. Parents and guardians must be present to give permission. And also, if this opportunity is missed, parents may call the Public Health Department to arrange for an appointment. I want to thank the staffs of Hawthorne and Monarch Grove, Judith Geyer and Ian Trejo, for making this happen so quickly. On another topic, the extended day activities at the middle schools, principals Diane Frost and Terry Elfrink spoke to you a few months ago about piloting some after-school programs for their students based on their student request and staff availability. We're happy to report several after-school programs in place. At Laguna Middle School, we have a chess club, a weekly chess club. We have a surf club put on by Mr. Whitman. There'll be no swimming activities, but I'm sure a lot of movies. I'll have to get that for you, Mr. Millar. You might get some pointers there, huh? Creature Crew or the science club put on by Mrs. Barnhart will take place after the spring break, so that'll be an opportunity for our kids in the area of science. We're continuing with the knowledge involved in that program. And then there are plans being laid for a mock trial club, a crafts club, and a drama club, but those are to look forward to in the new year, so they're getting momentum in these areas. Now for Los Osos Middle School, Dr. Elfrink has worked with his students and staff, and they're going to be offering four opportunities. The first one is an I Make It club, headed up by Greg Wilcox, and the students will predict results, construct, and demonstrate team-built catapults and individual gliders. So they're going to learn to create, collate, and build projects that solve problems. There's also going to be an online searching club conducted by our librarian, Vicki Rayburn, and students will learn to do online, they'll develop online searching techniques that will improve the quality of their results as they search the internet. There's also going to be a frog dissection seminar conducted by Dan Hoskins, and the students will learn the protocols for dissecting and preparing reports based on dissecting observations and findings. So that should prove to be very interesting. And last but not least, Jed Brewington is going to introduce students to a hands-on use of the Lego Mindstorm for Schools program. Basically, it's under the robotics title. So we'll be looking forward to students having experiences in those areas and possibly participate in some competitions. So we want to encourage our students to support the after-school program and get involved. We want to thank our staff for participating, certainly, but Also, you provide a late bus after school, and so this will, through this strategic plan, so students will be able to stay after school and participate. So this is the beginning of an after-school program, and we hope to report good attendance and to be able to show you some, the results of our projects. So last but not least, I'd like Mrs. Dallas Camp, our Director of Instructional Services, to take a brief minute and share the opportunities that we're providing our staff in terms of developing their skills. Mrs. Dallas Camp.
Let's see how quickly I can speak. I want to share tonight with you some of the professional development opportunities that we have provided for our district and school staff this school year. We've provided it in the following areas: regulars, our office staff, and our paraprofessionals. In the area of comprehensive literacy, our elementary teachers and administrators participated in fall and winter grade level in-services, as well as a Saturday in-service, which was presented by comprehensive literacy guru Gaysu Pennell. Should I lower this? In October, we had a teacher presenter by the name of Brad Fulton who addressed our secondary math teachers regarding concept development and Algebra 1. Our own educational technology teacher on special development has ongoing professional development related to EETT grants, that's enhancing education and technology, and teaching through technology. That's for grades 4 to 6. Power School, and our district-wide implementation of our PEGA projects. He's currently facilitating the development of resources for staff on internet safety and ethics, as well as a software and resources in service for parents. Our Student Services Department has facilitated crisis intervention team trainings as well as ongoing in-services for paraeducators during TCT time before they are ever placed in classrooms. And finally, our district's physical education teachers will be participating next Monday in the KFIRD Level 4 training. And it's our expectation that all of these professional development opportunities will enhance the knowledge and the skills of our staff so that we're always improving the learning experiences of all of our students. Thank you.
Thank you, Rita. Thank you, Mary. Oh, so Mary, isn't Los Osos Middle School going to need a mock trial team too? So that there can be, so just throwing it out there.
Yeah, we're very interested in high school kids mentoring middle school kids. Right. That's what we're looking forward to.
Good. Thank you for the report. Okay. Any else? Okay. The next, status of state budget. Wouldn't want to miss that. Mr. Miller.
I know. Kim says, very eloquent. But what we're watching right now is kind of a doldrums in Sacramento and their paralysis by inaction. However, both houses of the legislature have a education budget subcommittee, and both met last week, at least a year and a half, 2 years, that the actual revenues have exceeded the expectations. So remains to be seen if that'll hold true. And a lot of what they're looking at in terms of potential budget cuts, they're going to hold off until May.
Keep us guessing. So the changes that the legislature made in order to compete for the race to the top funds, those changes are still in place.
Yeah, that's not a budget issue so much, except for that we didn't get any race to the top money in spite of.
Okay. Any questions, anybody? All righty. Item 4 is positive certification of adequate funding. Julie Lang.
Hi. Good evening. Oh, this is right in my face. There we go. We are here tonight presenting our second interim financial report for your approval and also to approve all the budget revisions that have occurred since the first interim report. There really weren't a lot of changes to the budget. As you can see, our revenues went up by $307,000. That's mainly due to just some entitlement adjustments that we found out about, and also a couple of new grants that we received through a consortium with LucyMR. It's the homeless grants. Our expenditures also went up. The majority of this is just transferring money from one object code to another as needed. There was also some site work at Johnson Avenue and Grand Avenue sites, which is accounts for part of the difference in the between the revenue and the expenditures. As you can see, our decrease to the unappropriated reserve was $272,000. The majority of that was an interest adjustment. This time last year, I didn't think our interest rate would dip below 1%, but it has. So we went through this, the general fund and all the other funds, and adjusted the interest to something more realistic. And if you would like to see the detail of all the budget transfers that took place, those are listed on pages 4.9 through 4.12. If you turn now to the general fund summary, you can see the comparison between our revised budget, our first interim budget, and our second interim budget, and in our expenditure categories than we do in our revenues. So our beginning balance started at $20,648, and our ending balance is projected to be $17,201. I'm sorry? What did I say? Oh, sorry. Okay. We increased the 10% for economic uncertainty. That is related to the amount of expenditures, so that goes up when the expenditures go up. And made some other minor adjustments in the other categories. It left us with an unappropriated ending balance of $602,853. And on page 4.13, we included a simplified multi-year projection. I think that the one that they present in the SACS document is really hard to read. So this starts with your beginning balance at the beginning of the year. The 2009-10 projection is our second interim budget. You can see that our revenue limits are projected to decrease next year, and that's due to the state decreasing our revenues by 5.81% for our fair share adjustment, and also the projected $201 per ADA that the governor's talking about. Federal revenues are expected to remain flat, although we will be losing our ARRA money in 11-12, so that's why that is decreasing. State revenues next year are going to be hit with a negative 0.38% COLA. That will be about a 1.8% COLA for 11-12, and local revenue should remain flat. The salaries are budgeted with only step and column increases. They've been adjusted by our estimated retirements. Benefits include an increase of 8% to health and welfare in 10-11 and 5% increase in 11-12. And the other reductions to the other categories are due to the fact that we're going to be receiving less revenue, so we'll be having less money to spend. As you can see, with these adjustments, and with these projections into the future years, our decrease to the fund balance goes from $3.4 million to about a $4.2 million, and our undesignated fund balance by 11-12 with all these factors calculated, so things like lottery and mom monies that we roll over from year to year that we hold as a balance
that we spend in the following year after.
Right.
LDR. I got you.
Right.
Thank you. Any other questions, board members? Mark?
I think I understand this. And Julie, this is, thank you. This was very much easier to understand for me, being an English major. So this may be just an English major problem. Congratulations on the positive certification. I'm wondering, though, it's my understanding that the certificate, the note, go out 3 years. And as we're looking at the district having to make a $9 million cut, as I understand from the last meeting, is that going to change our qualified or non-qualified? Or
well, it'll change our ending balance. That's not part of this budget. That was done after we put this budget together. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it should increase the ending fund balance. That's the reason for doing that.
Are we in jeopardy of being, I'm thinking the term is qualified.
Qualified.
Are we in jeopardy of losing that with the county? I mean, most of the other districts in the county now are.
I think we would be if we didn't make any changes.
The reason that they give you qualified negative opinions about your financial condition is to move you forward in making the cuts and changes necessary to keep it unqualified. So if we do end up losing or becoming negative or qualified, it'll be because we didn't take the steps necessary to retain our status.
Okay, any other questions? What do we do tonight? Anything? What do you want from us?
It's a resolution, so.
It's
yes.
A resolution. Then you do want something. Okay. Oh, then is it the action item? No. Okay. All right.
I'll move approval of resolution number 090910.
I'll second it, please.
Okay. Any public comment on this item? Seeing none, we have a motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Buckman, to approve resolution number 0909-10. This will be a roll call vote.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Mr. Angel?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger? Mrs. Sheffer?
Give you some ideas of which ways you might want to go when you get that information. First of all, the Voting Rights Act in California is in the Elections Code, Section 14025, et sec, and following. And we just start with a very brief overview. It explains different types of elections that trustee areas, cities, and other local bodies and political subdivisions may use. And this particular district, like almost all districts in this area, elects its trustees from trustee areas, but at large, meaning that everyone in San Luis Coastal can vote for the trustees in both areas. And this is a very common form of election. There's been no showing that there's anything wrong with that. But under the California Voting Rights Act, if the area has racially polarized voting, and if that impedes the ability of significant minority groups to have someone elected, then if those two conditions are met, there can be a violation of the Voting Rights Act, which would then entitle a court to say, you got to change the way you elect your trustees. Now, no one has put a gun to the district's head, and there have been some districts in the San Joaquin Valley that have seen a lot of activity in this area because there is such a discrepancy between the minority populations in the community and the minority populations on their board. For example, there are some districts where there's a 50% discrepancy between the number of Hispanics, Latinos in the population and the percentage on their boards. Those are districts where there's severe underrepresentation of minorities. There are some where there's 25% difference between the minorities on the board and the minorities in the community. Those are considered underrepresented, and you don't fit into either of those categories. But you do have a significant minority population in San Luis Coastal, between 24 and 25% of the students in this district are Hispanic. Now, you have representation. You have a Latino board member. And to my knowledge and to the memory of the district, there has not been a problem with Latinos running for office and not being able to get elected. But you do now have one out of your seven board members who is Latino. So you have about 14% particular area that would be drawn using demographic data from the census, and only the people who live in that trustee area would vote for the trustee that resides in that area. Now, the way it's done now, everybody votes for all the trustees. That would change if you decide to move ahead at some point in the future and change the way you elect trustees. You would do that if it were found that there were racially polarized voting in this area. Now, the way that's done is with demographers coming in and making studies. Also, I think you'd look at the census data from 2010. As a practical matter, with that census ongoing now, you probably wouldn't be making any changes immediately, but as a practical matter, you might want to start the process of looking at it. There are several ways to start the process of changing your elections. One is by the citizens, and it's really not on the radar in this community. Another is by the county committee on school district reorganization, and they're not pushing this. None of the other districts around have done this yet. The third way is if you initiate a process to look into this and to use the census data to consider going forward, perhaps with the election in 2012. And in that election, half of your trustees would be up for election, so that group might be subject to new method of election if you decide to go ahead at that time and stagger it, then the rest of the trustees would be subject to the new mode of election in 2014. So you would be using census data from the current census and looking at possible change in 2012-2014. And once again, this is not something where you have a gun at your head, but I know the district is looking at this in a proactive way and trying to decide if this warrants action. The best way probably to do it would be to adopt a resolution, to send it to the county committee on reorganization, and they would hold a public hearing and then approve or disapprove the change in election methods. By doing this, it would probably make it easier for certain groups to elect a trustee. That is the goal of the Voting Rights Act, is that a group that can be represented in a smaller trustee area has a better chance of electing one of its own to the board. Mode of election, you might want to look at that, and if appropriate, direct staff to bring this back to you at some time in the future for action.
Patty, so the, one of the things the board could do would be take the action on a resolution based on the 2010 census data that may not be available until 2011 or some point there. So would we, if the board were to take action on a resolution, would it go to the county committee before these other things take place, like the census data coming in and our own demographic?
We could set it up so that it would move at the time that you direct the superintendent to do so.
And also, as I understand it, this California Voting Rights Act applies to all kinds of boards.
Correct.
In addition to school boards, water boards, and service community service districts,
cities, political subdivisions, community service district,
waterboarding.
No. There'll be no torture here.
So, okay. Any questions by board members? It was very.
Okay.
Oh, go ahead.
I just know that this is a huge, huge issue in the Central Valley, and that I think this is something that we need to take a look at, and I'd like to get further information on what a resolution might look like and what the implications of that could be.
Okay. Is that the consensus of the board this time, Mrs. Holmes?
I just have a question. Looking into the future, if some district were to enact this resolution and change its voting method, and let's imagine that an election takes place under this new kind of process, if a trustee is elected from these areas who is still not of that minority representation, so the composition of the board still is in discrepancy to the percentage of the residency, is there still a problem?
No, it might not change anything. Mrs. Holmes, if this method of election is changed, if there really isn't racially polarized voting in the area, it might not change anything. But the California Voting Rights Act finds a problem with an election system that's at large and racially polarized voting. So if you changed from at large to by trustee areas, you would be in a safe harbor under the statute, because you can't change people. You can't change people. I don't think we live in an area that is
Interestingly enough, some of the local districts in the Central Valley that have faced this actually did have very strong minority representation. The issue was not the strong minority representation on the currently sitting board. It was the method of that they were elected.
Yes. Some of the districts have a significant numbers of minority board members, but there's a group called the Lawyers Committee that still goes after them, particularly in the San Joaquin Valley, because overall in the state, there are probably 50% of the students that are Latino and only 15% of school board members. So statewide, the Lawyers Committee has been looking at trying to reform this, but they focus primarily on the San Joaquin Valley. And even where there are minority members, they have gone after those districts and forced the districts to change their mode of election at great cost.
And members of this committee, lawyers committee, at least a couple of them were instrumental in having the law changed, weren't they?
Yes, yes.
And I believe the law allows the recovery of onerous attorney's fees and expert witness fees?
Yes, yes, it does. And I think that, in addition to doing what this board feels comfortable with, does warrant you asking staff to bring this back to you for consideration.
Okay. Thank you, Patty. Any member of the public like to comment on this item?
Okay.
Seeing
Thank
no one,
you.
Is that the consensus of the board that we instruct staff to come back with additional information on the resolution? Great. Thank you. Thanks, Patty. Item number 6. Dr. Valentine.
Coffee break. I didn't want to go without you, Mr. Millar. For questions and discussion. As something of a preamble, we want to note that we have been working for several months with a variety of constituent groups to clarify budget priorities from different perspectives within the district. Specifically, we have facilitated multiple sessions with school site council representatives, the District English Language Advisory Committee, parent representatives, curriculum council leaders from every site, principals, classified management, and district management. Community meetings have been conducted simultaneously in English and Spanish. We've also held multiple informal conversations with PTA presidents, and those conversations with all groups continue. When we began our discussions, we were anticipating a $7 million problem. The governor's proposal and subsequent developments have increased our estimate to $9 million. An itemized breakout of the problem amount is included in tonight's backup. Our template notes that we are operating on a $3.4 million deficit in the current year, which, if not addressed, will carry over. It notes that the state has added a net $2.2 million of cuts. It shows the $1.5 million of federal bailout money, which will disappear shortly. And finally, it shows anticipated cost increases of approximately $1.7 million, add it up and round it off, and you have the basis for a $9 million template. We believe we can reduce some of the elements of the $9 million problem, but we caution that changes resulting from the governor's May revise and in the legislature's final rendition of the budget are likely to increase the problem amount. What we share tonight, however, is not a recommendation related to specific numbers and solutions. Those will develop over the next couple of months, but rather a way of thinking about budget problems that give shape to our conversation. For discussion purposes, we will use the $9 million number as a stepping off point for our conversation. Before we can address any problem, it is important to establish the core values that will drive our thinking. We've simplified our suggestion to three: sustaining the mission, preserving the workforce, and maintaining prudent reserves for the long haul. We recognize that even these simple values compete with one another. For example, we find similar jobs elsewhere in this economy. As a result, our first look is at cuts which minimize the elimination of jobs occupied by ongoing staff. We mentioned that we have been working extensively with various groups on budget and strategic plan priorities. We've boiled down dozens of pages of input into the summaries provided in tonight's backup. While the groups were diverse, their input was remarkably congruent. You can see almost universal support for English learner intervention, counselors, professional development, after-school, summer-school programs. We're grateful to these groups, and we're not done yet in refining their input. What follows in our backup is an itemized approach to eliminating nearly $9 million of cost from the 2010-2011 budget. I mentioned that this is not a recommendation, but rather a way of thinking. I will add, however, that while this is not a recommendation, it is rational. It addresses the $9 million problem. It uses a combination of budget management to reduce current deficits, a portion of reserves to bridge some of the gap, staffing reductions through non-replacement of retirees, and spending cuts which do not eliminate the jobs of continuing employees. It validates the continuation of reading interventions, counselors, English learner interventions, and other programs critical to those who have provided us with input. It is not so far from our core values that you can't recognize them in the template. And still, there are features of this which require further discussion, specifically the reliance on reserves, the absence of professional development, the reduction in site flexibility, the disappearance of instructional materials, the reduction of after-school and summer-school opportunities. Are our assumptions about deficit reduction or reserve use realistic? Have we identified all the resources we might bring to bear? And so forth remain unanswered. So if it's not a recommendation, then what is it? Put simply, it's the shape of the solution. Wherever we land in this process, it will involve a list like this, with a defined problem and a list of budget actions which add up to the problem amount. It is also the agenda for discussion. It drives us not to say that this is valuable or that is valuable. Returning to the template of cuts, I want to draw your attention to one item in particular, the last one, which proposes to reduce staffing by not replacing 15 retirees. This staffing reduction saves a lot of money, does not take a job away from a continuing employee, and produces savings year after year after year. Such a move has impact, however. It increases class sizes, it shifts personnel, and it creates program challenges when specialized individuals are not replaced. Such things can be avoided by using reserves. If you increase the amount of reserves dedicated to our problem amount, you can reduce the number of cuts. But there are problems with that. Specifically, the use of reserves addresses a problem for only 1 year. The problem reemerges the next year, requiring us to find more reserves to address exactly the same problem, plus any growth of the problem.
Excuse me.
When reserves are gone or become inadequate, there remains a large problem, compounded by years of growth. And at that point, we either hope that the challenges have gone away and happy days are here again, or we expect a balloon payment to be made in the form of layoffs that will touch real people. One of the benefits of incremental staffing reductions through retirees is that the savings continue over time and reduce the need for cuts every year, and consequently reduce the risks of layoffs to continuing employees. None of this guarantees that there will be no employee layoffs or loss of jobs. We have shared with the board that we are not renewing temporary contracts until we know the final budget problem amount or until some drop-dead decision point, whichever comes first. Our hope is to handle the staffing reductions through the attrition of retirees, but we are holding on to other staffing solutions to provide the board with flexibility in responding to still greater problems. There is awkwardness in this approach to staffing. Schedules need to be built around some assumptions of staffing. Very soon, we're going to have to tell our sites to build their schedules around a certain level of staffing, but to understand that as things change in ways we can't predict, they may be asked to change their schedules and their assumptions of services. I can't tell you how proud I am of everyone stepping up with a whatever-it-takes attitude. We can't emphasize enough that our budget challenges are a multi-year. The disintegration of reserves is the disintegration of our capacity to react to any fundamental change in our funding. We started this presentation by characterizing it not as a recommendation, but as a way of thinking. We've shared with you the ingredients for thought, a definition of the problem, a set of core values, some guiding assumptions, a rational response, a plan for the unknown, and an overall rationale for the approach. Ultimately, a recommendation will come forward from the superintendent. It will be highly influenced by the work of all the constituent groups we have described. You will know the input on which it was based, but you will also know that the responsibility is mine and the recommendation will be mine. The final outcome is yours, and that's the way we're thinking now about the budget. Be happy to take questions or respond in any way.
Chris?
Thank you for addressing the email that I sent you, because I had to ask you some questions about this.
Sure.
Just to sort of frame this, my understanding, at least with, for example, Paso Robles, is that they did use up their reserves in past years. I believe it was the last 2 years. And one of the issues that Paso is now facing is that they have to replenish their reserves because they don't have any more well to dip into. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. A significant piece of their strategy has been to try and bridge through each year with usages of reserves and doing layoffs and all of the budget cuts. They've cut as much as they can in their budget. They've used as much of their reserves as they possibly can, and now they're going to have to cut even more of their budget in order to replenish their reserves to the 3% minimum.
And I want to thank our folks for really looking at this, because a story that I don't know if people understand, in my wanders throughout the state and talking to people in the state, one of the districts in Northern California didn't make some important decisions that they should have made. At the time, they thought they could get through things without doing it. Later on in the year, when the budget cuts were really forced upon them, there was a member of the County Office of Education sitting in the front row of their board meeting ticking off the things that they had to cut to get to $3 million worth of cuts. And I hope we never have to get to that situation. One thing that I have an interest in is the process that we do this, and I think that what I'd like to see is, if not the tiered approach that we used in the past, I'd like to at least see some alternatives for getting to the reductions, understanding that your recommendations are your recommendations to us. I know that we'll be hearing from the public, and rightfully so. That said, I think we need to continue to work on it. $9 million is a tremendous problem, something that we've never faced before. We face the huge issue that we face. Probably percentage-wise, it's about what we faced in about 2000. But still, it's significant. looking at how we use our reserves, I think is going to be significant too. So I ask you to continue to look at that.
Will
I look
do.
Forward. Well, I don't look forward to it. I wish we didn't have to, but I appreciate what we have to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mark?
Thank you. Two questions just for now. I think it's important if you could give some context to this, and if you could tell us, either you or Russell, what percentage of our budget right now goes towards personnel, so we have a sense of...
Within our budget, 85% plus or minus 1% goes to the combination of certificated salaries, classified salaries, and employee benefits.
And administrative salaries.
Pardon?
And administrative salaries.
Yeah.
Okay.
Classified and certificated. All salaries.
Okay. And then if you can help me understand, because I've had this question, we are hearing about a $9 million cut. And what I'm hearing is in Atascadero, they're looking at a $3.7 million cut and some other numbers around the county. This number, when talking to people, sounds high compared to other districts, and I'm just wondering if there's some explanation for that.
Well, I can give you the I'm an English major too, so
I have a calculator at
okay,
if you want to
I can give you the English major explanation, and if you need detail, Russell can jump in. Part of the issue is that we're running at a $3.4 million deficit right now, which means that we are budgeted to spend $3.4 million more than the revenue that we're going to take in. If we don't do something, and that's a big if we don't do something for the remainder of this school year to reduce that number, that's $3.4 million of our $9 million problem for next year, a big if. That's $1.5 million we're going to have to find. So as we keep adding these numbers up, the $3.4 and the $1.5 million represent one-time solutions in the current year that won't continue into the future. What will continue into the future are the state cuts, and these are the ones that you can compare to other school districts, I think, and represent our fair share, and that number is about $2.2 million to San Luis Coastal. The only other figure that factors into this is the fact that no matter what you do, costs increase, and we anticipate a $1.7 million increase in costs. Two predications in here. Number one, that we don't do anything about the deficit, and I can promise you we will. And number two is that the ARRA money may carry over longer than the year that we're looking at. And number three, the problem is predicated on running exactly the same program that we currently run. And while we can't tell you what the recommendation will be, we know that the recommendation will represent a reduced program.
An additional piece to this, that when we compare ourselves to revenue limit districts, there's one important facet in the state cuts that tended to benefit us in a way. The revenue limit deficit in 08-09 was about 8%, and it grew to about 19% in 09-10. The state imposed a fair share of pain upon basic aid districts, but they did it 1 year in arrears of the revenue limit cuts. So while they had to cut 8% in 08-09, our $1.7 million worth of fair share occurs in 09-10. And while they cut 18-20% in 09-10, our $2.5 million fair share of pain will occur in 10-11. So we're 1 year in arrears on that piece. The other piece that would account for the difference in terms of size versus cuts, is that Atascadero, Paso Robles, and CMR have been going through this will be their third year of substantial, severe cuts to programs and people. Layoff notices issued and withdrawn, programs cut, all of those things. Mm-hmm. And what we have done and what we did in the construction of our budget for 09-10, current year, we made a cognizant decision to use our reserves to bridge through the 1 year, not do layoffs, not do program cuts, but to actually invest in our programs and people.
For of the backup material, and tell me what kind of budget ledger domain.
I'm sorry, what, tell you what?
Well, so explain to me how we get a hit by 1.3
$1.5 million.
Okay.
$1,350,000 on 2010, 2011, $201 per ADA reduction, and then down below in the subtotal for last year's per ADA reduction, we end up, it looks like, with money coming in. It's reducing our deficit.
First, let's address the $201 per ADA reduction. It's a great example of our governor telling us a big lie, okay? So that's the cost of his lying to us. In 08-09, the state took from all districts a one-time hit of $250 per ADA with the promise it would never happen again, and education for the second time in 3 years bought into the story and raised no substantial objection to it. Our lobbying efforts didn't fight for it. Okay, we'll hit it for 1 year. We can do our contribution. Well, in this year, his proposal is a $201 per ADA cut, but it's not $250, so he kept his promise. And the $201 translates to $1.3 million for our district. And it's a reduction in revenue limit, so it's a long-term hit on revenue limit districts, and we're going to be expected to pay the same kind of fair share on that one. Are you addressing the $1,688,000 down there at the bottom? That is a difference. It's the way we're depicting our fair share of pain. Up at the very top, the second number is $2,534,000. That represents the 2010-2011 fair share of pain for basic aid districts that I was just talking about. That's 1 year in arrears. It's what revenue limit districts are paying this year. We also pay this year $1.7 million, and what Ed has done is move the number of 2.5 there and subtract out the 1.6 from this year. So that's the subtraction of the 1.7 million. I call it 1.7. He's very exact in his numbers. 1,688,000.
You'd expect that from an English major. Then, I'm sorry.
Can it be and it will go away. So next year you won't have $1.6 million problem. He did that. And then he created a $1.3 million different cut that virtually negated it, and it appears up at the top. The numbers I was quoting was the arithmetic I did.
Okay. And then this is not just idle curiosity, but it may be a little tangential. All these hits to revenue limit amounts, are they going to also hit our – because we do, as you know, have a revenue limit amount. We're what's referred to as a low-wealth district because
they
our
do.
Revenue limit amount is so low that if we revert to revenue limit district
– we have a revenue limit, as you state. Right. It is. Compared to the other counties, I think we're second or third from the bottom should we be a revenue limit district. If we lost basic aid, that's where we would be. As these hits occur, they are – There's a complex form that you file every year, and you go through an arithmetic formula, and you do the calculation, and you use your revenue limit, and then you put in your property taxes. And for us, our property taxes exceed that whole formula calculation, but the basis of the calculation is the revenue limit. And as it decreases and decreases, then the formula that you end up with the answer is small. Okay, because it's a function of multiplying our students times that revenue limit. And so as our property taxes remain the same, we're actually becoming basic aid by a greater margin because of that. And if we were to lose our basic aid, if the state were to borrow our excess local property taxes, if something like that were to happen to us, we would be reverting to a very desperate state in terms of what our revenue limit would give us from the state calculation.
And my question is a little bit mechanical. So while the revenue limit districts have their revenue limit amounts deducted, 3%, whatever it is, do basic aid districts have their underlying revenue limit amount deducted by that 3% as well?
Yes.
Okay, so that's what you mean by we're getting more basic aid because our revenue our already low revenue limit amount is going lower while our revenues are staying more or less even.
You an English major, too?
I was worse. Oh. I was a public administration major.
Oh, okay.
No qualification.
No, good job. So, that was well done.
Okay. Thank you. And
at least you had the good sense to avoid public administration.
Thank you. Well, not entirely. Mark.
I know I like the way you administer the board. Pacific Beach in here, and are we looking at the, I think it's rental income from Avila, and the possible sale of Johnson occurring possibly next year. Is that figured in, or is that just in a Fund 23?
No, actually, the underlying concept for each of those is to make it general fund accessible funds. And the methodology used for that is not to sell the property, but to have a long-term lease to it that generates an annual income. And that is accessible for general fund purposes. If you were to outright sell a school site, as an example, you would be required to put it into a holding fund, if you will, for the future purchase and use of another school site to replace it. The state feels that it's inadvisable. You can get some waivers on this, by the way, but they feel it's inadvisable for you to sell school sites on a short-term basis that you might need for a long-term reason. And so they require you to use it for, without a waiver, they require you to use it for the purchase and construction of a new school.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thanks. I'm sorry. I may have missed the answer to the question, but in the assumptions that are here, in these dollar amounts,
yes,
are we making any assumptions on based on potential,
no,
on the rent that, and on the, I thought we did sell the corner at LOVR.
No, we will wait to make those budgetary assumptions until it's more concrete in terms of when and how much and all those things. Even though we have a contract for, excuse me, like with Avila, we would await the final construction so that we know that the timing is right to declare it.
Okay. One of the ongoing budget processes, though, is to make sure that we've turned over every stone regarding our revenues, and that process isn't completed yet, and there may well be a proceed from the Froom Ranch, which was $75,000, that might help us with $75,000 of this problem.
Okay. Just, this is an easy one. This is a real quiet one. May I?
No, I'm sorry. Do you still? Because Phil's waiting.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, hi, Mr. No.
And we have a speaker request, too. So.
Oh, take a breath, huh? Oh, I forgot what I was going to ask. Not really. Did we vote last year to increase our reserve from 5% to 10%?
Yes, we did.
It was from 7 to 10, I
7
think.
To 10. And so is that part of our structural deficit, $6 million on page 6.6 of our reserve money to fixing the problem? Is that how I'm reading that?
One of the options that, one of the constructs for this is to, go ahead.
Now, this is a template. The number $2.6 million was not arrived at as a decision about reserves. It actually was thrown in there to offset the class size reduction penalties we would experience by increasing class sizes in K-3. It is a number that hasn't been vetted and to which we are not committed.
Right. It's just making sure we're not saving money and making cuts at the same time.
Yes.
Putting money somewhere else. Okay.
Yeah, the answer to that is no, we wouldn't do that.
Okay. I'll take a breath now.
And by the way, I think that Marilyn had a better handle on this than I. It was from 5 to 10% in the economic uncertainty.
Is that what you were going to say?
I was just going to ask. I can't remember on the funding of the GASB, what we had a certain length of time in which to fully fund it, and I can't remember what that was.
That's 20 years is the actuarial report that we gave the parameters for.
And how long have we been?
I think we're in our fourth year, and next year would be our fifth.
Okay.
Is that your?
Okay.
No.
Is Mrs. Holmes? No? Okay, thank
you. She's just whispering in my other ear.
Do we?
I just. Okay. Request. This request is actually of Mrs. Holmes.
I'm an English major, too.
I know, and this is kind of English majory. as I look at the three recommendations that have been gathered, three
core values.
Sorry, please.
The core values.
No, the actual the site council, the curriculum council, and the management priorities. Would it be possible in the Friday memo and or at the next meeting to have these so that they actually, as Ed said, they, most of them do line up? Could we see them in a format, and I'm assuming it's possible, to where they do, where we can actually see them lined up? Would that?
I'm glad you asked Ms. Holmes that.
Okay, because I can't do it on my computer. Thank you, Kim.
Okay, we have one request to speak, Jim Questenberry. Jim?
Can I ask one more question?
Debbie Heck is raising her hand, and I will go to the public generally in a minute, too. Yes, Mr. Angel.
On
part of those groups.
Okay. That was going to be my next question, so thank you.
Okay. Mr. Questenberry.
I can comment on that. In the past, the Teachers Association was included in some budget considerations and planning. I sat on at least one committee. This is a comment that actually responded originally. The letter was, or the email was to Dr. Valentine regarding his issues and answers. And so I'm going to read you part of that and just some additional comments. I see that there is, in the way of thinking, some effort to consolidate. But here's my take on things. We'll call this my take on things. I hope that the district is planning to elevate and consolidate district administration. As the superintendent retires, I recommend that his position should be filled from the ranks of the highly qualified and competent administrators within our own district. Then we should carefully decide which programs and/or district initiatives can be eliminated, thereby eliminating an administrative position without necessarily laying off an administrator. I would be glad to help the district identify programs and initiatives which teachers find onerous and inefficient. Some of these would devolve to the site level and some would disappear. It is clear that the state has lifted many restrictions on some categorical programs which require district oversight and management. Now is the time to restructure and consolidate those. I am certain that the district administration will show the same flexibility and adaptability that teachers and support staff have shown and will show in the future. If you choose not to replace retiring teachers, then those teachers who continue will be dealing with increased class size and significant changes in their assignments. They will rise to the occasion. Should we expect less of our district administration? I think not. Remember, elevate and consolidate and promote within. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Debbie Heck.
Oh, sorry.
And
hi. This wasn't prepared in advance. I was just taking notes as Dr. Valentine was talking, and I just have a suggestion of how to save $1 million. Dr. Valentine was talking about that when we put some of those teachers, maybe half of the half, so maybe 20 of those, with other teachers that are about 10 years experience, that puts them about $60,000. That would save our district $1 million year after year after year. So I'd like you to consider an early retirement package for people that are getting close and would be interested in that.
Thank you. Anyone else like to address the board on this issue? Okay. Seeing no one. Mr. Buckman.
It had to be me at the end. Sorry.
Let's go.
Chris, and those of you that were here, we had a time, I think it was not too long ago, there was a $5 million cut that we needed to make. And at that time, not only did we take input from this, there was several community committees or advisory committees to the superintendent. Is that, am I right? Okay. At some point, I'm just wondering.
If I might, I'm sorry I missed the question about the representative groups and so forth. The The curriculum council includes teacher representatives from every site within the school district. The school site councils represent parents from every site in the school district, and a parent participates in the conversations. We made a conscious decision to try to include school groups knowledgeable in at least their own site goals and perspectives to be able to provide insight into the district process, but that we wanted insight from parents and we wanted insight from teachers. And by the way, the association's vice president is on the curriculum council as well. So, you know, you get a good cross-section through all of those. And in a sense, the process that we've kind of described has been our approach to getting informed and intelligent input from various constituencies in the community through this.
Mark, I'm not sure that's what you were asking about.
Well, Dr. Valentine, when you talk about the various groups that were represented, I guess, whose views you took into account, I didn't hear any budget project team that included community members, district employees. It was a cross-section of people. And the superintendent's advisory group was a totally different group, not having anything to do with the budget cuts that the district was talking about making. But I think that what Ed's done is just tried to take similar input but structured it differently is what it's sounding like to me.
So, if I may, I think you're going right to my question because you did use the word community. And while I appreciate the hard work and the effort that's gone into this and that I hear is going to continue, I think that there may be a powerful knowledge base in the community of those that are not immediately associated within the education family, the parents, the staff, and the curriculum council. So I'm just wondering if at some point we want to consider coming up. What's the term you used? Not the superintendent's.
Well, it was the budget project team, but it was a major production number. It didn't just get, you know, pulled into shape in a week or two. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm.
If we have, I don't know.
I'm looking. I'm just asking a question because I know the $5 million cut took a long time to come to, and we're looking at $9 million now. So it's
wasn't
almost,
it $10 million that the district had to cut at that time?
Yeah.
It was 2 years, 10
the,
years.
And the process was months in the making. We have kind of gone down this road and are about ready to wrap up the input process and start developing a recommendation. We can go back to the drawing board if that's the board's wish. Just know that our intent was to provide that kind of input into the process. And we're pretty confident that we're hearing what people value in our budget.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I would like to make sure that our classified rank and file have input into the budget process and the budget recommendations as well.
I just wanted to give you a little history on that previous round of very painful budget cuts the board had to do so many years ago. And this kind of input and this process was followed first by Dr. Ladd in gathering input from existing organizations before it went out to those huge community-wide events that specifically targeted every employee group and the community at large, who sort of reacted and added and subtracted to the kind of material that you have before you now.
Thank you, Kim. Yes, Mary.
May I just to piggyback on that? And I would add that what the suggestions that that group came up with were only suggestions, and that ultimately the decision was
about budget cuts. I remember the whole the whole round of things that we were doing, but I have to say that this is a much more surgical
kind of approach to what we have to do. And I appreciate this initial collection of input from folks. And we've got a lot of meetings where we're discussing the budget between now and our adoption of a budget in June. And these are public meetings, so I would encourage the public who wants to speak to these budget cuts to show up. And I don't know what we should do about public input. Ellen, you were involved in some of these committees.
Yeah, way back when we went through that, there were, I was, one piece of it was a rather, it wasn't expected to the extent that this is. It had was a problem that had been growing over time, but all of a sudden the community was struck by it very strongly, and measures had to be taken quickly. And the different one of the other differences, Mr. Buckman, was that those meetings were facilitated. We hired outside consultants to come in. There was a very large time commitment on the part of the participants. They occurred over months, it seems, and meeting very regularly with a large group of people. I think that a difference now is that we're all in this together, the state, the country. This is, we know that this is going to occur, and it is a matter of looking very carefully and thoughtfully at what's before us, but there isn't the same level of surprise or the unknown or, oh my gosh, we have never been down this path before. We felt very alone that our district was facing something that was unusual and was not occurring to anyone around us. And is that how you recall it as well? So it was very different. As Marilyn said, I think the way to go about it can be done perhaps a little differently.
Mr. President, in addressing the tenor of things that are different now as they were before, I think we need to remember that the budget crisis of 2000-2001 was generated by two significant events. One was we had distributed all of our reserves. We had none. And PG&E went bankrupt.
Right.
Those two things caused the crisis to erupt in a matter of days. When poor Steve Ladd comes on board July 1st, and on July 5th, he's cutting substantial cuts in the budget. Those events.
In fact, we were saved by the housing bubble.
Yeah.
In fact, the esteemed chair emeritus of the board at that time, Mrs. Andreen, is here. I don't know if you want your 3 minutes to make any comments or not, but you don't have to. It's just...
I do have recollections of it, and I went to some of the budget project team meetings and also sat on the advisory with Ellen. So it was two separate processes, and the budget project team was a huge undertaking. It's not something that you could just throw together now. And I sense a little bit of what Ellen said. The public didn't understand what was going on at that time, and they needed, I guess it doesn't sound very glamorous, but they needed to be primed and informed so that they didn't mutiny when we said some of the things that we had to do. And we had to give some strong medicine, and the public needed to understand the reasons for it and to have buy-in. And I think, as Ellen says, they now do understand, and they do have buy-in when cuts are made. They may not like the cuts that have to come, but I think the public at large understands that cuts are necessary, and that the district has to do things that are going to be unpopular. So I don't think it's going to take that long process of immersion to get the public ready to accept some of the things. Sure, they're going to say their views on which cuts need to be made. As they're publicized, I'm sure members of the public affected by them will come. But I'm not sure that they need that long immersion process that they did need back in those days wasn't just part of the way the world works, that cuts are made every year now almost in most districts. So, you know, maybe getting some additional input as the board.
The participants were asked to do, they were given the budget that's based on the strategic plan, and they were asked to choose the top five that they could not possibly do without, and the bottom five that they could possibly live without. And so when you use the word strategic and surgical, I think that it is a very efficient and effective way of helping us all identify, you know, look at what, and it's reflected in this report here, but looking what the groups agree upon and the things that rise to the top. So it's very helpful in that way.
Yeah. Ms. Jenna Gould?
Just one quick comment about the classified is in that site council process, many of our site councils have classified members on it. So when we went forward with the district with our site council, we were represented, our classified as well in that process.
Thank you, Janet. Would anyone else like to speak to this issue? You don't have to fill out a slip or anything. And, Mr. Unker?
One more comment. The third leg of the stool that brought us to the crisis in 2000-2001 was a purely political decision by the State Board of Equalization to cut the unitary tax that PG&E paid. And I would just remind people that we're essentially a political decision away at all times from becoming a revenue limit school district.
Okay, so anything further on this agenda item? I will be back. We'll be doing plenty. I've got the cut signal over here. We still have a number of agenda items left, but do we need a five-minute break? Should we plow ahead? Well, I was doing this for you, of course. Oh, should we go? Pardon me? Okay, five-minute break. Madam Clerk, please set the timer for 5 minutes and prepare your truncheon. Uh-oh, we're losing the crowd. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are back in session. The AGP folks are kind of giggling. They can see a lot of different meetings, and maybe this one gets a little rough sometimes. All right, so the next item number 7, is approval of Title I Part A and Title I American Reinvestment and Recovery Act waiver application and plan. Mrs. Delkiskamp.
The Act funds. Our district and schools intend to use these funds next year in order to support Title I instructional programs as we continue to align our program services with our decreasing funding. With your approval, staff intends to submit this application and plan to the California Department of Education so that it may be approved by the State Board of Education.
And Rita, so we want to be able to carry over 85% of our Title I, what's the abbreviation?
ARA
funds. Does that mean the waiver we're seeking is for a waiver of 70%?
It's a waiver because what the standard is that, right?
Okay.
And so we want to have them allow us more than 15% carryover.
Okay, but so if we want to carry over 85%, we're allowed to carry over 15%.
That's correct.
We're asking for a waiver to allow us to carry over 60% more.
Yes.
Or 70%.
70%.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
Quick question.
Yes.
And I'm sorry if I didn't get it out of here. How much then would we be carrying over if we get the waiver?
Okay. If you look at page 7.10, it lists the amounts there.
Oh, it was sideways. I don't.
Excuse me?
It's a sideways page.
Yes, it is. It's box 4.
So it's a total of those?
Yes.
So, okay. So it's a lot of money.
Yes, about 85%.
Well, in dollar amounts, it's a lot of money.
Yes, because the total amount was $325,000 or so that we received for Title I ARA.
So what about that money? Okay, thank you very much.
So, let's see. Do we need this to come back?
Actually, it's really important for us that it be approved.
Okay. I think we should maybe have a motion.
I was going to move. Approval of Title I, Part A, and Title I, American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, ARRA, waiver, application, and plan.
And I'll second.
I couldn't have put it better myself.
Catherine?
Moved by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, seconded by Mrs. Roger. Any discussion by the board? Any public?
Solar electric project. And the other one is the Johnson Avenue property map overlay, changing the zoning on that property that fronts on Johnson Avenue. Both projects are extensive in terms of planning, implementation, timeline, and cost. Both programs started during the time that Mr. Parker was our director of budget, director of BG&T, Buildings, Grounds, and Transportation. And he was the lead on the projects, primarily because he had demonstrated an expertise in the area of real estate and the manipulations in order to achieve the results that we needed in both areas. He had extensive experience with the district during the Measure A rebuilding and dealing with construction and other issues related to property. I think the important points to remember is what we're looking for with these contracts for Mr. Parker to continue to perform the oversight of these two projects is one, continuity. Once started, we have a momentum. He has relationships. He has built up understandings with city staff, with the solar people, and there certainly is a lot of momentum within those relationships. The timing, okay, so as we go forward, if we break with that particular piece that Brad performs, then somebody has to step in, get caught up to speed, and then move forward again. There is a cost-effective piece to this in that if we don't have Brad in the lead, then we're going to be looking for some interactions with Oasis Development, with attorneys to oversee the agreements and the progress we make. And ultimately, what we need to remember, too, is that the funds that pay for Mr. Parker's contracts don't come from the general fund. They come from the building fund. So it doesn't impact our budget issues, and it is a fund that has in excess of $500,000 in it, so it certainly is affordable. For the solar contract, we are looking for a maximum amount of $39,000. And from the Johnson Avenue property, it's $23,400. The sum total is around $62,000. Timeliness of the relationships that he's developed over the years.
Okay. Mr. Unger?
Yes. I had some concerns about this based on $62,000 in consultant fees when we're looking at a $9 million budget problem. Would you, just for the benefit of people listening, describe why fees paid out of the district's building fund won't affect the $9 million that we're talking about right now?
Two points to help with that particular piece. Our building fund is a very restricted fund in what you can spend the money on. It isn't available for general fund purposes. It has to be related to property and those types of projects. It isn't available to help us assist in any kind of a budget crisis issue. We can't transfer money from the building fund into the general fund. That's not allowed. So it has very singular purpose dollars attached to it, and that's what we do. The other thing to remember is that both projects are money makers for the district, that when we spend money to get money, we're really getting a very nice return on both the solar project and the Johnson Avenue eventually once it comes to fruition. So they're both projects that were brought to the board as enhanced revenue type projects. when we went through the 2000-2001 budget crisis, one of the things that the board directed was, what can we do to avoid this type of thing in the future? And obviously Johnson Avenue came up almost immediately at that time. The solar project is a recent development.
And just one more question. Mr. Parker did a yeoman's job on all of these things for our school district. He's retired, and I wish him well in his retirement. How are we going to assure that the current staff gets to the same level of expertise that Mr. Parker has?
A good question, and I think that most of the projects that would come up will fall under my purview and oversight in the future. It's something I'm comfortable with. It's something I've done in the past. It isn't foreign territory for me, so those types of things. I would mentor Mr. Guy in his role as director of BG&T now, and we would move forward with a dual.
And at that time, there had been discussion about retaining him in some capacity to continue to shepherd those things. I think that he really showed us with the Avila project how important his continued participation was, and knowing that this doesn't come out of the general fund, it seems to me that this is a really good way to use some of those monies that we don't have need of. We don't anticipate building schools in declining enrollment times, and the monies involved here are not major monies. I would assume that these are not to exceed figures.
Correct.
So if for some reason we hit some hurdles and had to spend more with Mr. Parker's firm, that you would come back to the board.
Absolutely.
And ask for an increase.
Two things which we'll do in case that happens is that I will become more involved on a oversight basis on these projects, so that the timing of the whole thing can be continuous. If we hit some hurdles, we have to take more time. It might cost more money. The board will have options at that point.
No offense intended, but I think Mr. Parker is a much smoother operator than you, Mr. Miller. So,
who isn't?
Yeah.
Maybe that's a compliment,
well
though.
Taken.
You know, I'm not sure.
So. I'm okay with this, particularly Johnson Avenue, which is just now getting into the pipeline with the city, and Brad has a lot of experience with getting the necessary approvals and what have you. So I think this is money well spent against future dollars
Mark?
To be realized.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for the endorsement.
I have a question. It's my understanding that one of the things that Paso Robles is possibly looking at is they have the ability somehow, and I don't know if it's to borrow money from their measure fund and use it and then promise to pay it back. And
they might have a bond.
They have a bond. It's a bond money.
Yeah.
Is there no mechanism in
Not
the state
us.
That allows us to borrow from our building fund with the intention of paying it back?
No, I don't think fund or any of our other funds, but you have to pay it back by the end of the fiscal year. So it's very restricted on how you can use it.
Well,
yeah, by the end of the fiscal year.
That sounds like one of those shark guys. Thank you for the answer.
Let's see. So, if Mr. Parker had not retired and was still ramrodding these projects for us, where would his salary have been paid from?
His salary would be paid for from the general fund.
All right, so we're saving general fund money.
Well, we're paying his replacement, and his replacement has a replacement. So,
yeah. And both of these contracts are terminated on December 31st, 2010, so any additional business relationship would come back anew to the board. I also think we already made this decision, at least gave staff direction that is what we wanted to do as far as these two projects were, to continue having Mr. Parker in some capacity to supervise these projects. And these contracts represent that staff step to put that in motion. It's approximately a 7-month contract on both of these, $62,400. How is that vis-a-vis Mr. Parker's salary prior to his retirement? Because as I understood it, we were going to attempt to engage his services to continue these two projects, but we were going to attempt to do it as essentially on par with his previous compensation. How did we work out that?
I don't know how to answer that one. I think that I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but it represents probably 50% of his salary.
Without benefits.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a straight.
But that's the best I have an answer I could give you at the moment.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to make sure, because as I remember the discussions leading up to this, these two agenda items, those were the parameters that the board was attempting to keep the relationship with Mr. Parker within.
Yeah, we had brought it to you upon his retirement, anticipating the issue. The termination in December of 2010, the solar project should be well down the road, and Johnson Avenue has, you know, some unknowns attached to it. But what we're looking for is to get the approvals, the EIR process, and basically get everything lined up for the overlay to be approved by the city. The city can impose things on us and change things on us. And
appreciate you clarifying that it comes from a fund that can't go towards salaries or educational materials, I guess.
Okay. I just, in my role of old guy on the board, during times of budget crisis, school districts still have to spend money. And yes, it becomes a thornier issue each time we have to make a decision, but we can't be immobilized because of our concern about the deteriorating budget situation. I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Miller?
Yes, ma'am.
May I take the two items together? Separately or together?
Oh, I think we should do them separately. We're approving public approval of a contract.
I will move approval of item 8, an agreement between Cardinal Consulting and San Luis Coastal Unified School District for the solar electric project.
I'll second. Any further discussion? Public input? A motion by Mrs. Roger, a second by the chair. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Passes 7-0. And we'll now consider item 9. And if any board members have any additional questions specific to this one, we don't want to cut that off. So, anybody have any? Okay. All right, I'll move approval of the agreement with Cardinal Consulting and for Johnson Avenue Property Entitlement Project. Okay. Motion by the chair, second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. Moving on to item 10, Dr. Matakovich.
Yes, I have before you a revised board policy 5131.7, students, weapons, and dangerous instruments. This is a first reading. We've taken the recommendation from the School Boards Association to amend our policy to reflect basically a timeline that we're required to meet in terms of reporting any offenses that were to do it within one school day. And we've also added, as you can see from the board policy, the term school security. That would entail our campus security officers. So I present this to you for your consideration.
Might look like I don't know if there's such a thing as licensed security personnel. I guess what I'm wondering about is, does security personnel mean rent-a-cops coming onto our campuses carrying guns? And so I just need a little more clarification on that.
Yeah, and
otherwise I would approve it, but I'd like that brought back with just some explanation on that, please.
Very good. We don't have authorized security personnel on campus with weapons. Our law enforcement officials come, and they are, yes.
So we don't have any security personnel who are armed?
Correct.
Firearms?
Correct.
Okay. Is that good, Chris?
Yeah. I guess this still says that, and so I'm asking for some clarification for it before, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would ask that it be brought back with that. That's okay. All.
Very good.
I'm not even sure we need the term security personnel if we're not using it. And also, I believe, I can't remember that there is a reference, and I believe the penal code, to what constitutes a law officer. And I wish I could remember the section for it, but it might be more specific than just using law enforcement personnel. Because it sets up a whole category of folks who are police officers, probation officers, folks who are considered law enforcement for purposes of being armed. So you might want to look at see if there's a more specific term within a code that would cement that. And I guess anything can be a weapon if you want it. Not anything, but a lot of things can be a weapon if you want it to be. So I do think we cover it well enough that dangerous instruments can basically be, a chair if somebody decides to hit somebody with it, or two. So I actually was trying to think of something that couldn't be a dangerous instrument, and marshmallows was as far as I got. And I don't mean to make light of this. I think it's a serious issue. I'm also concerned about pepper spray and tear gas on campus. And I don't know how we deal with that other than through the ARs, since there is a legal possession that's authorized for some people. And I know this the law allows.
It's noted in the last paragraph.
Teenagers to have tear gas. But,
so if you read the last paragraph of the current board policy, may legally possess tear gas.
Okay. Yeah. Do we have, is that in the student behavior code? And,
it's very explicit.
The booklet?
No, I'm sorry. Tear gas. Pepper spray and tear gas.
Well, we shouldn't. Tear gas is fairly specific. It used to mean CS tear gas. I don't know exactly what it means now, but pepper spray is a legal substitute for something like tear gas, and that's the issue. I think as long as we're clear about it in our student handbooks, and I agree with Chris, I'd be careful about using the term interchangeably. So, Catherine, and then Mark. Okay.
Dr. Matakovich, this board policy requires the school and the district to report to law enforcement when a student has a weapon on campus. This is just a point of information. Are law enforcement authorities required to inform the school or the district when a student is in possession of a firearm, a weapon, in the community?
I don't know the answer to that.
It seems kind of relevant, and I just wonder if we should just have that information available to us. I don't know that it belongs in this particular board policy, but it would be... It's just an interesting question to know whether we're informed if there's a student who's carrying a weapon in public.
Yeah, and actually this kind of came up at our Monday meeting, and it probably relates to some extent about our partnership with juvenile probation and those kind of authorities. And also, while you're exploring that, just the idea that a student of ours involved in serious crime off campus, I think should be reported back to the school district too.
And we are advised of through law enforcement of charges that have been filed or that have gone through the court system, yes, if it pertains to if it is a safety issue relative to the school, certainly.
Now,
so we work with probation. And
does that require a student to be
noticed?
A 601 WNI where they're the juvenile justice system actually takes parental control of the student? I think maybe
this is actually one of the mandatory, as I understand, one of the mandatory reasons for suspension, mandatory for expulsion, which then comes under the superintendent's purview or the principal's purview whether to move forward with it. I would like to ask the board to change it to shall be subject or something stronger than are subject, so that we get the message hammered home a little bit more. So I don't know if you want to bring that back or not.
Well, as a general comment, the recommendation is typically to make board policy not less specific, but not that specific, and then the specifics are handled in the administrative regulations that support it. Or subject to suspension and or expulsion in accordance with the law. That basically makes that reference. So if it's a Ed Code mandatory expulsion, then we would be acting in accordance with the law under those circumstances. But that's just my input on it. Anybody else?
I don't think I can support the shall. I'm more comfortable with the R at this point.
Okay. And then down to the paragraph that we're adding, when we have a principal or designee shall notify law enforcement authorities. And I know that there's Ed Code that says that we need to notify the teaching staff of these types of incidents. But when I read school security, I was wondering, is that the school resource officers that we have at the high school?
Did they get automatically
notified?
Yes.
So
that's a requirement?
It is. It's already a requirement.
Okay. Well, that's why we've included it here.
Well, that's what I'm... Okay, so that's... Chris, is that what you're understanding of what we were talking about?
Well, I was thinking, actually, in that paragraph you're talking about, I was thinking about that refers to not necessarily the school resource officer because they're law enforcement, but our campus security guys.
Thank you for the correct term.
Up here in this first paragraph, just is so generic about security personnel. That made me really nervous.
Okay. For my clarification, are we understanding that this is the campus security when we say school security?
Reading?
Yes, sir.
Oh, we do.
We'll
bring it back.
Right.
We were going to ask you to come back with some additional info. All right. And next we will do proposed board policy 5136, students gang. First reading, it's item number 11. Dr. Matakovich.
Yes. Over the course of this year, we've had discussions relative to disciplinary issues and a concern for where we are relative to gangs in our school district boundaries. And I reported to you in meeting with the gang task force that at this time we have no residential gangs within our attendance boundaries. However, staff, administrators, have asked if we would you would consider adding this policy to our board policy book. It would allow staff to work with students who might be approaching these decisions, and it provides us a construct in which to work to involve in-service training for staff, as well as being able to work with our students relative to the reasons why they might become involved in gangs. So this is a policy presented by CSBA, and this is a first reading, making it available for your comments.
Yeah, I would just like to add or like to encourage the notion of a reference to the community in here, and that it's a community problem. I'm not sure where that would go, but I'd like to see something like that, or at least, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Again, in the first paragraph, we're going to establish mutually supportive efforts with local law enforcement authorities, and I'd like to suggest campus security or our own security. I'd also like to just make a comment that we need to understand, or I'm under the impression that while these are CSBA recommended policies, we as a board can always go above or beyond what's recommended. And in that vein, and I don't know whether it fits here, Mary, or not, and we may already have it, but this talks about providing training to staff and with the skills they need. Is there some place that already exists or where we can add training to students so they have skills in refusal, and maybe training for parents to be for the students? I shall ensure. The last paragraph, it talks about that. There are schools of conduct dress code. I don't want to read through this whole thing, that we would somehow educate staff. I'm sorry. Student designees shall provide in-service training which helps staff to identify gangs and gang symbols. Mm-hmm. And what I'm wondering is if we can go beyond that, either here or somewhere else, and maybe it's a future agenda item, to develop a board policy that supports providing skills for students and for parents. And that policy may already exist, but it popped into my mind as I read this.
Again, I'm just looking at paragraph 3, that the board realizes that students become involved in gangs for many reasons and lack of refusal skills. Age-appropriate violence prevention education shall start with students in the elementary grades. Is that getting close to...
Yes,
to what you want?
Yes, it is. I don't know if we need it stronger or not. My guess, my sense when I read this the first time is that we needed some stronger wording. And then I'm still feeling that we're leaving parents out of the loop on this.
Okay.
Mark, thank you. Mark, what about ongoing age-appropriate violence prevention education shall start with students in the elementary grades?
I think you're a wizard.
Okay.
Works for me.
Are we taking on new responsibilities there, or by? Or we're already doing, I assume, age-appropriate.
Peer pressure, bullying,
yeah,
the decision-making skills. Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and conflict resolution.
Correct.
Yeah. I have to say that one of my concerns when I read this is that I think we need to keep our focus on the individual student's behavior. And yes, or there may be some aspect of it that is gang related, but fundamentally it's the individual student's behavior. And sometimes we can, I thought one of our expulsion situations was a fairly cut and dried guard, should I even use those terms? A fairly straightforward, factual set of student misbehavior that somehow got conflated with gang, wannabe gang members and things like that. So
age-appropriate violence prevention education shall start. So I'm not sure, are we in agreement with Ms. Rogers' comments about just ongoing? Are you talking against that?
I mean, to add the word ongoing age-appropriate violence prevention as opposed to...
Yeah. Because
I assume it is ongoing.
Well, this limits it to elementary grades. And and the wonderful programs you pointed out are all the way throughout K-12. So if we just did ongoing and students in all grades.
Okay.
Well, I think gang violence...
Start programs... We already have programs in middle
school. We do have them, right? I believe we do.
Elementary, middle school, and high school, yes.
Okay. Bill?
Gang violence and gang membership represents a significant blow to our educational culture here. One of the reasons people move from the Valley to San Luis is because the influence of gangs is all over from fourth grade on up and probably even younger grades in the Valley. So... I wanted to ask, is there any teeth to the board policy if we do encounter a student who is repeatedly involved in gang activity on campus? Is that something we can suspend for or expel for to get make sure the rest of our students are safe?
Yes, it's listed in our conduct code currently.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. This first reading, and Mary, you've got... Mm-hmm. Your
things. Okay. Item 12, designation of board subcommittee to review proposals for superintendent search and individual member input to said subcommittee. Mrs. Holmes.
I have all the scoop. Some resources, and we're able to send out requests for proposal to 10 different firms. As of today, I have received 3 responses, and I expect that those are all we're going to receive, but we do have until Friday to see if any more come. It takes a while for the mail that might be rejected to return to a sender, and today I received one of those original solicitations back from a company whose name we got, who is apparently no longer, and looked at having those presentations made to you next week on the 23rd. So I've sent an email alert to the companies to kind of put them on notice that that's the date we would ask them to come forward. I haven't had any responses yet to whether that earlier deadline is going to be a problem for anyone, but we're really hoping that it won't be.
And your emails were to companies that have responded to alert them that they need to be prepared to make a presentation on the 23rd?
Of the 10 names that we sent solicitations to, I only had email information on 4. So for those 4 companies, I sent an email notification about the earlier deadline. So there is a 4th opportunity of someone that we have that kind of immediate contact with. Depending on the discussion we have tonight, I can make some telephone contacts tomorrow and see if I can reach any of the remaining firms. The discussion about a subcommittee was in the event that there might be such a larger number of responses that you wouldn't be able to handle all of those. I do have some questions that I'd like you to kind of discuss in terms of the procedure on the 23rd about these firms making their presentations. Would you like to do that similar to the way your board interviews were held, in that firms who haven't yet made their presentation are sequestered in the other room and not privy to another presentation until their turn?
I think so, yeah. And anybody? Everybody? You gotta use your mic. If you want it to, you should want to use your mic.
I guess I would want to. I would want to sequester them if it's a question and answer situation. If it's just simply a presentation, that's they've already prepped for that, and I don't know. I can't see the reason why we would want to.
Well, they've prepped for it individually. I don't know.
Yes. I see it as similar to the solar. Energy folks who presented to us, and we did sequester them so they didn't hear each other's presentations.
It's true, actually. All right, yeah.
Excuse me. Who has the Toyota hybrid?
Why is it
driving around by itself?
White?
Lights are on.
Ah. And have been all night.
Ooh. And if you ever need a lawyer, God forbid. Do you remember the presentations before?
I remember that we had, I think we only had 2 groups that presented to us the last time, and I think they took about, I'm probably making this up, about 20 minutes is all. I don't think we need a whole lot of time. And they had written materials presented for us too.
Yes, we do have those. We've requested materials, and I've brought the ones that have submitted already, but we've requested them to give us sufficient copies so we can distribute those. I'll be sending those out on Friday. So you'll have those over the weekend to kind of study and be prepared.
Do we want to, in an excess of caution, figure out who we might want to have on a subcommittee in case we get a flood of responses, and then we'd have the subcommittee in place that if we did want to do a preliminary assessment of those, they could just go do it. We wouldn't have to post anything or do anything like
right.
that.
Right. Our deadline for receipt is Friday at 2 p.m. So I'm wondering if you might want to select a subcommittee, and those people could arrange to meet Friday afternoon so that we could Well, we'd hopefully be sending these things out Friday morning for delivery to you, but we could make a Friday afternoon delivery.
Well, you could give us an initial count of how many we've received, and then we know whether or not the subcommittee can just stay home and wait for the board meeting. Meaning if we get a few, if we have like three or four, as we do now, I don't think we need a subcommittee if we have three or four. I don't know how everybody else feels.
I think the likelihood is that there might be a fourth one, but
okay. All right.
So, I'm fairly confident that's all there would be.
All right. Let's no subcommittee. We're going to handle this together. All right. And we need veterans of the previous searches. Okay. I don't either. And me too. Okay, so we're not going to appoint a subcommittee tonight. If we get some major situational change, I mean, let's face it, if we get like eight applications, then we can't do it at April 23rd meeting without doing some initial elimination. Dr. Valentine, how's the card?
Well, throw out the idea of perhaps designating a subcommittee in the event of, and we won't use the subcommittee, but if we wind up with eight of them, we have nobody to call.
So, Alan, Phil, and myself, okay. But I think if we have four, there's no need. If the number goes above four, then there probably is a need, and we are not entertaining a proposal from Cardinal Consulting, correct?
They seem to be everywhere these days. Okay, and so we'll go with that subcommittee. Do we want Catherine and I to be notified of the numbers and tell the subcommittee to go to work or not go to work? Or?
Sure.
All right. Okay, so if you could let us know on Friday, just send us an email, and I know Catherine's totally plugged in. I'll have to make sure I check at home. So.
Do we need to elect officers for the subcommittee?
will there be travel involved? Okay. So, Kim, did we do what we needed? Okay. Let's move on to the action consent agenda. Let me know if you'd like an item pulled. Approval of certificated and classified personnel items. Okay, number 13 pulled. 14, approval of temporary athletic team coach qualifications and competencies. 15, acceptance of donations.
Pull that, please.
15. 16, disposition of surplus property. 17, approval of furniture and equipment requests. And 18, approval of purchase orders. It's too late. Wow, we didn't do so well this time. I'll move approval of 14, 16, and 18. All right. Okay. A motion by the chair, second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor of approving items 14, 16, and 18?
Yes.
Aye. Yes. Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. 13.
Okay, as quickly as I can. Mr. Robinette, please wake up. I have a very simple request. As we do these in the future, would it be possible when we're doing hirings and to list whether these are temporaries, probation ones, whatever other categories they are that we're hiring?
Yes. We typically indicate if it's a temporary employee. Otherwise, they're a category as substitute.
Mark, seconded by Ellen. All in favor? Aye. Passes 7-0 and 15.
I just wanted to acknowledge that Baywood School received a generous $2,000 donation from Mary and Joseph Dooling for the summer school program. Thank you very, very much.
Really?
I move approval of item number 15.
And okay. Thank you at Voila as well for Pacheco's summer science program, and I'll second Chris's motion.
And on behalf of the board, I'd like to express our thanks to the other folks listed in this item for their donations to our schools as well. And the item 15 moved by Mr. Unger,
Seconded by Mr. Angel. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. Item 17. Marilyn. Uh-oh.
17.
Oh, Phil.
Oh, that's right. So do we have a server that went out? Did I ask you this at lunch? I don't remember now.
Actually, we try and keep one in inventory, and the last one that we used was in order to bring the Follett library system up to speed. And so the one that was in replacement now is serving the Follett software, and we're replacing our inventory so we can respond in case one does go out.
Excellent. That sounds great. I move approval of item 17.
Motion by Mr. Angel, second by Mr. Unger to approve the furniture and equipment requests. All in favor? Aye.
Fine.
Opposed? Passes 7-0. We're on to advanced agenda. Catherine.
Thank you. It has come to my attention that the board has a policy. It's number 5137A, which is to promote a positive environment on our school campuses. And this has to do with we have ARs that have to do with cyberbullying and bullying and such, you know, playing nicely on campus rules as those. What also comes to my attention is that we do not have an AR that would have to do with the inappropriate use of what would fall under penal code or education code as a hate crime. Use of demeaning words or actions that are as a result of specifically towards someone's, whether it's their gender, their race, their sexual orientation. And so I would ask for a future agenda item for us to explore, helpful to our site administrators, to have some regulations that they might refer to if they have incidents of hate crimes on their campuses. And so I guess this is really directing staff to look into that and bring that back to us.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yes.
I wouldn't want us to be writing ARs, but I think we do have an interest in making sure that the groups that you've mentioned, all groups, have equal protection. And I know that's a legal term, so I'm not sure if I'm using it correctly, but we do need to assure safety on campuses, and that would include freedom from hate crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I'm very much in favor of having this as an advanced agenda item, even if it's just merely to direct staff. It's just an incredibly important topic. There is, unfortunately, still racism and hate crimes. They do exist. They do exist here in our community, and you know, schools are a haven, and we need to protect our students.
A little unclear. So, Mark supporting it as an advanced agenda item, and I couldn't tell whether you were waiting. We're going to have staff come back with information on ARs.
I would be satisfied with staff coming back with information on an AR that would support our positive environment board policy. Are you okay with that, Mark?
As would I.
Okay.
Thank you.
You've got direction, you guys? Okay. Excellent. Any other advanced agenda items? Phil, you had your light on. Okay. That's still important to me. Perfect, because we're about to blow out of here. oh, no. Save it. Save it for next time. Nobody's going to hear it.